in the theater, having a crush, and listening to music, which could, quote, awaken the dormant susceptibility to passion, end quote, a.k.a. the pastimes of any pubescent girl. Regardless of when Aunt Flo came a-knockin', if you didn't get married as soon as you soiled your first pair of panties, you were fucking up. The 1900 book The Wife's Guide and Friend declared, many of the irregularities of menstruation in single women are often cured by marriage, and are in such cases nature's sign to a woman that she is not leading a natural life. And if you felt like shit when menstrual, you were, well, crazy. According to an 1894 gynecology textbook, menstruation should be as painless and as normal as defecation. Sigmund Freud and his broad-hating brethren believed period pain was psychological, stemming from penis envy. Because of this, physicians at the time wouldn't treat women suffering from menstrual pain, instead referring them to psychiatrists in order to discuss the rejection of femininity. Being in pain when you were on your period made sense, though, since menstrual blood was toxic, or at least thought to be. In 1920, the physician Bella Schick noticed that flowers handled by his female lab assistant wilted much faster when she was menstruating than when she wasn't. This led him to postulate the existence of a menstrual toxin, or menotoxin, secreted through women's skin during menstruation. According to Schick, menotoxins also prevented dough from rising and beer from fermenting. Pharmacologist David Macht took it a step further in 1924 by declaring that menotoxins could be exercised through perspiration, saliva, urine, milk, tears, and the air breathed by menstruating women. The husband and wife team of doctors Olive and George Smith injected menstrual blood into rats and, upon seeing that they fucking died, concluded that menstrual blood must, indeed, be toxic. The alleged existence of menotoxin was soon used to explain pathology in women of reproductive age. As any woman could secrete it from any bodily fluid at any time, merely being a woman made you pathological. Which is a comically inaccurate misbelief that, frankly, I wish were still seen as true, as I would love for men to literally view me as toxic and avoid me for one blissful week every month. Ah, but how to shuttle that diseased blood from out of your diseased womb? In the late 1800s, methods of menstrual hygiene included pads made of sheep's wool, after, of course, applying lard to your vulva in order to protect against dampness, duh, raw cotton wrapped in cheesecloth and inserted like a tampon, cute little crocheted napkins attached to homemade belts, and my favorite, nothing. As most clothing was dark, many women just bled into their clothes. Toward the end of the 19th century, when cloth became easier to come by, what happened to menstrual rags after your period was over indicated your wealth and social status. Rich women tossed them, poor women washed and reused them. Which makes me feel slightly better about my decrepit collection of period panties. Turns out I'm part of a rich tradition of poor women making do with less. The multi-billion-dollar feminine hygiene industry as we know it started around World War I. Lysol was sold as a feminine hygiene product, used as a post-coital douche since contraception was, at the time, illegal. By 1911, doctors had recorded 193 Lysol poisonings and 5 deaths from uterine irrigation. In spite of this, the product was aggressively marketed to women as safe and gentle, with ads declaring it, quote, will not harm delicate tissue and will, quote, safeguard dainty feminine allure. Not only was it dangerous, it was ineffective. One 1933 study found that 250 out of 507 women who used it as a contraceptive ended up getting pregnant anyway. Lysol was still promoted as an antiseptic douche throughout the mid-century. In 1931, a Denver physician named Earl Haas invented the first tampon. For the next half century, they were sold in the United States with little to no protective oversight, which meant no federal guidelines were in place when Procter & Gamble released Rely tampons in 1978. The super-absorbent tampons, which could soak up to 20 times their own weight in fluid, caused dryness by absorbing the vagina's natural humidity. This often led to ulcerations in the vaginal wall when they were removed, making it easy for bacteria to enter the bloodstream and for the user to get toxic shock syndrome. From the moment they hit the market, there were reports of ulcerations, lacerations, and lesions. Before they were even widely distributed, the manufacturer of Rely was alerted to the suspected link between their product and TSS. Still, they chose to conduct no research on the connection, a fact that came back to haunt them when injured women began to sue. Between 1975 and 1980, 95% of women who contracted TSS, a rare, life-threatening bacterial infection, were menstruating at the time, and 100% of them were tampon users. A study of TSS victims found that 71% of them used Rely, which was eventually recalled in 1980. The same year, tampons were classified as Class II medical devices by the FDA and thus finally regulated for safety. Ah, but what makes a woman? The ability to get TSS from a high-absorbency tampon? Some women are born biologically male and never feel at home in their own bodies. Some feminists, however, feel that womanhood is predicated on biology, excluding trans women from female-only spaces and political movements. There's a term for these women, and shockingly, it doesn't rhyme with runt. It's TERF, or trans-exclusionary radical feminists. TERFs believe that trans women aren't women, and instead are men merely play-acting femininity to, I don't know, get their jollies off? To which I counter with a question. Who the fuck would choose to be a woman? Womanhood is a prison no sane person would ever enter flippantly. Yet the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders still classifies being trans as a disorder, gender dysphoria specifically, which was reclassified in 2013 from its original title, Gender Identity Disorder. While homosexuality was removed from the DSM in 1973, transsexuality was added to the sexual disorders category in 1980. The fact that it's in the DSM implies that it's problematic. Yet without classifying it as a medical disorder, sex reassignment therapy would be viewed as an unnecessary cosmetic treatment and thus not covered by insurance. The same percentage reported not seeking medical treatment because they were unable to afford it. Not that it really matters. In the United States, transgender people are less likely than non-trans people to have health insurance, and often faced insensitivity and downright hostility from healthcare providers. According to the 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey, 33% reported having negative experiences with a healthcare professional. That's the same percentage of people who reported not seeking medical treatment because they were unable to afford it. Being trans increases your risk for anxiety, depression, low self-esteem, and suicide. The USTS found that 40% of transgender people had attempted it at some point in their lives, compared to a national average of 4.6%. Trans youth are particularly vulnerable. Researchers found that they're routinely bullied, with three-quarters reporting that they felt unsafe at school. And with the exception of a handful of cities and states, it's legal at the federal level for parents to make their trans kids undergo conversion therapy. There's also no federal law designating transgender as a protected class or requiring equal treatment. Some versions of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act introduced in Congress have included protections against discrimination for transgender people, but the ENDA, which would prohibit discrimination in hiring and employment on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, hasn't passed as of now. The USTS found that 30% of transgender people reported being fired or mistreated at work for being transgender. It also found that 46% of respondents had been verbally harassed and 47% had been sexually assaulted at some point in their lives. So, again, I ask, who the fuck would choose to be a woman? When you are one, biological or no, your body itself doesn't matter. It's how it's policed, co-opted, mistreated. You don't choose it. It chooses you.
So I wanted to talk for just a second about your whole experience with buying a pair of pants that were 00.
Mm-hmm.
When I was doing research for this, I found out that when I was growing up, what used to be a size 6 is now a size 12. You know, they didn't used to have 0 or 00 as sizes. They used to start with the wacky idea of size 1 and sometimes size 2. So I wonder what, so I guess 0000 would be 1 and 00. There's not, are there 3 zeros or only 2 zeros?
I don't think we've gotten to 000 yet.
Oh.
Although if we have, then this world is worse than I thought it was. And I thought it was pretty bad in the first place.
So I also like the idea of menotoxins. That seems, you know, really adaptable to the Me Too movement. I don't really know how we're going to use it, but it seems like it would be a good kind of a superpower, like, stand back or I could poison you with my menotoxins.
Yeah, it could be like our venom.
Mm-hmm.
Like whenever a dude invades our personal space, we could just spray him with it.
Kind of like Peter, what's his name, Spider-Man does, where
Parker.
You just, yeah, Peter Parker,
mm-hmm.
you just shoot it out at people.
Right.
Menotoxins.
Yeah.
Let's quickly trademark that and get it and sell it to Marvel.
Again, yeah, I don't know, we're still here. You should be throwing your gym membership in the garbage, and then we should be going to the patent office.
Right now, we're headed there as soon as we're done with our discussion.
Fire up the Prius.
I just totally love the idea of men discounting period pain, like they would have any clue what period pain would be.
Right.
It really is like, I hope those men, the men who came up with that, at some point had to go to a urologist who was a woman who said, no, you can't have any pain in your penis. The penis is a perfect organ and it never experiences pain. There must be something wrong with you if you think you feel it, because it's not possible. The penis is perfect. There is no such thing as penis pain.
Oh, your penis is burning? That just means somebody must be talking about it.
Ha ha.
Chapter 7, Crime.
We sing of King Hammurabi, his code we still study today. But Mrs. Morabi had no code or hobby, she just put the laundry away.
Putting the laundry away,
This chapter is about crime, and I want to say right at the front that I personally have never committed a crime, except for the one time when I was 15, and I stole a can of truffles because I didn't have the cash for it, and I'd never tasted truffles. And I learned a valuable lesson, which is crime doesn't pay, and also just never dream of eating canned truffles. They are horrible.
Good to know. I've only committed one crime in my entire life, and that was when I egged a Mormon church in a Blockbuster video in high school. Which is something that I am not going to give you any context for at all. But I will tell you that I'm delighted to finally have an excuse to talk yet again about marital rape. Yay!
Well, I do have a special section for you on marital rape in my area.
My prayer candle worked.
You know, I tried to make sure I mentioned marital rape in this chapter because I know it means so much to you, even though it means pretty much nothing to me.
Well, I tried to wedge it into the women in entertainment chapter, but then I realized that Harvey Weinstein's wife was the only woman who didn't rape.
No, allegedly. Allegedly didn't rape.
Allegedly didn't rape. You're right. There's a high likelihood those 60 women are lying about him.
You know, you're way too focused on rape. I just hope you understand that there's more to crime than rape. In fact, women have been making great strides in all areas of crime, and this is the area where I would like to make a joke about how women are becoming as terrifying as men, but it gives me a rash to even think about it.
Wait, but I thought violence was supposed to be empowering when women did it. Are you saying that the Kill Bill franchise lied to me?
No, not a feminist icon, Quentin Tarantino. He wouldn't lie to anyone,
He's an ally, baby.
He is.
I love QT, yeah. As much as he loves feet.
A crime is generally thought of as an unlawful act punishable by a state, but obviously different cultures criminalize different things. One page I found on the internet claims that in Sweden, during the long dark hours of winter, it's actually illegal to complain that you wish it were sunny. I hope that's real, because that's my idea of a very appropriate law. If my house was a country, I'd find any guest who looked me in the eyes and started telling me about their journey, or at least wouldn't offer them my famous fruit and nut platter, which I'm sure you've all heard I serve to my guests to thank them for their patronage. But as far as real laws go, ground zero for women as a group being specifically targeted as criminals based purely on gender goes back to 2400 BC, the beginning of recorded history and the laws of Urukagina in Mesopotamia, where some legal official wrote on a crumbling tablet, "If a woman says..." And then here the text is illegible. "To a man, her mouth is crushed with burnt bricks." Hopefully at the time they were a lot clearer about that text that was illegible. You really don't want any guesswork involved when the threat of burnt bricks on your mouth is on the table. Also, there were no laws involving burnt bricks crushing the mouths of men. Only women were eligible. This girls-only law thing was, unfortunately, a trend that seemed to catch on. Not too much later, a single Sumerian tablet was found containing the following reference to sexual morality. "If a wife hates her husband and says to him, 'Thou art not my husband,' they may throw her in the river. If a husband says to his wife, 'Thou art not my wife,' he shall pay her one half a mana of silver." So, in other words, he commits a homicide, but she gets a little change for the meter, even though she was polite enough to use the word "thou." Sounds fair to me. By 2000 BC, it was the Code of Hammurabi for 1500 years, which we all know was an eye for an eye. As it turns out, female adultery was a two-eye offense. If the wife was caught in the act, she and her lover were strangled. Other than that, she had nothing to worry about, unless she belittled her husband, or spent too much money, or created a scandal.
because all of those would get her, you guessed it, thrown in the river. Oh, and the husband had immunity. By the way, note to female time travelers to this period planning an itinerary, remember to avoid cities near rivers. As you read through history, this gals-only stuff keeps on trending. In ancient Assyria, 500 years later, women who were deemed honorable needed to wear a veil in public. But if prostitutes or servants who were clearly dishonorable tried the same thing, they would have their clothes removed, receive 50 blows, and have hot asphalt poured over their heads. 3-in-1. I believe that's called a hat trick. Thank God for the ancient Egyptians, who were a lot more egalitarian. At least in theory, women stood as equals to men of the same class, and were even allowed to live life as single women, without male guardians. Maybe because the royal lineage was still traced through women, and no one wanted to get nailed for having negged the mother of the future king. Which brings us to the classical Greeks, those sons of bitches, who felt, unsurprisingly, that adultery was a crime for gals only. It was more serious than rape, which was just, you know, normal sex, but female adultery was seduction, betrayal, and property damage, with the part of the property being played by the women. With all that at stake, what do you want to bet the courthouses were located near a river? Although if a Greek man wasn't in a homicidal mood, he could opt for making his adulterous wife stand in the marketplace for 11 days in a transparent tunic with no belt. And we've all seen those tunics. They totally needed a belt to pull that look together. So that was punishment on two levels. Men, on the other hand, were expected to dally with slaves, prostitutes, and courtesans of both sexes. And none of this was considered adultery. Because, come on, be serious. Sex with a prostitute or a boy slave was the ancient Greek equivalent of attending a zoning board meeting. It's weird what a serious offense adultery was for most of civilization, considering how now it's so common it's practically a resume builder. In ancient Rome in 289 AD, the Christian emperor Constantine the Great boiled his wife alive for being suspected of adultery. But he got his. Constantine was later canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church. So he's having to spend all eternity with anxiety-ridden elderly Catholics praying to him for annoying favors. Things were a little less draconian by the 6th century, where the Byzantine Emperor Justinian decided that a woman convicted of adultery would be locked in a monastery for 2 years while her husband decided if he wanted her back. And if he didn't, she was shaved, veiled, and then locked up again until she died. Which is kinder than boiling her alive or condemning her to live without a belt. By the Middle Ages, women's involvement in crime had really expanded. Of course, the fact that the medieval prison was mostly about debt collection might have been a contributing factor to the high total. You know, like the hacky comedians say, women be shopping. Still, an examination of 9,000 indictments from a 21-year period in London in the 1500s showed the proportion of male inmates to females remained 25 men to one woman, with the ladies tending toward nonviolent theft of smaller, more portable objects like money, wool, articles of clothing, and fairly small amounts of grain of all varieties, perhaps predicting the future popularity of whole foods. Unlike now, arson seems to have been something of a woman's crime during this period. Maybe women trying to warm up before getting thrown in the river. But before we write off women as criminal lightweights, they also made up 7% of the suspects in homicide cases, proving themselves entirely capable of killing humans of both genders and children as well, using everything from a knife or hatchet to a poker cue and a fire iron. However, one interesting difference was the medieval urban woman usually had an accomplice. 64% of them were involved with a partner who was their husband or lover. The same report also shows that the chances of her avoiding a death sentence were slightly better than for her male counterpart. One more reason for the men to be pissed at her. Of course, it pays to remember that since we are talking Middle Ages, any home court advantage the ladies ever managed was kind of negligible. Especially in light of the Inquisition, which started in 12th century France to combat religious dissension, then went on to become the most elaborate extortion racket ever. Not only was the property of the accused confiscated upon arrest, never to be returned, but the prisoner had to pay for her own imprisonment and torture expenses, kind of like a medieval Vegas package deal. Which brings us to the golden precious 500 years of witch trials and torture across Europe and Scandinavia, where all it took to be a woman in crime was scolding, nagging, or threatening your husband. In fact, this was such a faux pas that in Scotland, in the mid-1500s, during what I'm guessing was a slow period for innovation, they invented a form of punishment exclusively for ladies they called a scold's bridle. A scold being a term given to a woman described as a nag or a shrew whose talk was judged inappropriate or rude. The iron scold's bridle resembled a muzzle with a padlock at the rear and a projecting spike that went inside the mouth when closed. One dated 1633 on display in the vestry of a church was inscribed, "Chester presents Walton with a bridle to curb women's tongues that talk too idle." Oh my, what fun they had with the rhymes in the Middle Ages. In 1524, 1,000 witches were burned at Como. 500 were burned within 3 months in Geneva. 400 in one day at Toulouse. In 1586, the female population of 2 entire villages was wiped out. An estimate I read postulated that as many as 200,000 women were executed as witches. But I'm sure they had their reasons. Take the so-called Witch of Newbury, who was spotted when she was surfing on the river and murdered by a group of soldiers before Brian Wilson even could write a song about her. To and fro she fleeted on the board, standing firm, bolt upright, reads the account of her dastardly deeds, turning and winding it which way she pleased, making it pastime to her, never thinking who perceived her tricks. Most of the soldiers were afraid to touch her, but a few brave souls ambushed the board rider as she came to shore. They slashed her head, beat her, and shot her, leaving her detested carcass to the worms. Try and work that into lyrics, Jan and Dean. No surf city for you, witch lady. At least the men of the church were precise when they made up their list of how to spot a witch signs. Among them, pale blue eyes, red hair, freckles, moles, warts, birthmarks, pimples, pockmarks, cysts, liver spots, blemishes, insect bites, wrinkles, signs of melancholy. They also knew to beware of women, quote, too vocal about their preference for living alone, too sullen, superstitious, atheistic. Geez, I would have been such a multi-hyphenate. Oh no, do not let me have another past life regression. Oh God, too late, where am I? It's 1528 and I'm surrounded by old men wearing robes. Geez, do they really think I'm naive enough to fall for this Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, Charlie Rose kind of crap? What? Why are they asking about my bug bites? Those new ones? They were fire ants. They happened last weekend when I was gardening. Well, except that one. That was a tick. And that one is what my dermatologist said I should tell people is a wisdom spot. No, I swear I am not sullen or melancholy. This is me looking happy. See how my eyebrows are raised? That's me showing delight. Yes, I lived alone for years, but not anymore. Help, somebody bring me back to a time where the term witch hunt only refers to a presidential personality disorder.
Meryl, not only would you look prettier if you smiled, you'd feel better if you woke up.
Would I? I would. You're right. Oh, thank you, Megan. You saved me again, and you're right. You know, I feel as refreshed as if I'd been thrown in the river. Good to be back in. Where are we again? Oh, yes, the 1600s, a time that also gave birth to a female criminal of great originality named Mary Frith, who called herself Moll Cutpurse. Talk about a hyphenate. She was a thief, entertainer, broker of stolen goods, and a publicly known comedic and musical performer of bawdy songs and lascivious speeches. She was arrested for swearing, being a drunkard, keeping dissolute male company, and fencing stolen goods. Plus, she would play the lute while dressed in male clothing. But not content to rest on her laurels, she went on to start one of the first male escort services ever. Truly an inspiration to sociopaths of every era. And she did this at a time when the average married woman was stuck living inside a law known as coverture, a legal doctrine in which a woman's rights were subsumed into those of her husband. As jurist Matthew Hale said in his commentary on the laws of England in 1765, husband and wife are legally one person. The legal existence of the wife is suspended during marriage, incorporated into that of her husband. If a wife is injured, she cannot take action without her husband's concurrence. A married woman could not own property, sign legal documents, enter into a contract, obtain an education against her husband's wishes, or keep any salary for herself. Coverture was also at the core of a ruling against marital rape, in that a husband could not be charged with the rape of his wife since a married woman had already agreed to disappear herself into her husband. So what are you going to do, charge him with raping himself? By the way, how sad that the church forgot to add that to canonical law. Amazingly, since it was part of the common law of England, coverture was not officially overturned until 1991. On the bright side, this was also the time of the most beloved of all domestic customs in English common law, the rule of thumb, meaning that a man could beat his wife with a stick as long as it was smaller in circumference than his thumb, probably making the micro-handed ancestors of Donald Trump a very hot medieval date. This rule was seen as improving the treatment of women since it placed a limit on violence for the first time. So see, ladies get lucky. Overall, research seems to show that progress for women in crime has been slow but steady. During the period around the Enlightenment in the 1700s, in certain countries like Scotland, females were proportionately more than twice as likely as their male counterparts to be indicted for a violent crime. In the courts of Surrey alone, in southeast England, there were 34 women charged with murder. Of these, 3 were accused of killing with knives, 4 struck their victims on the head with a club, poker, iron spit, or pewter drinking pot, 1 used a pistol, and 2 were prostitutes charged with throwing a client out a second-floor window from which he was vainly trying to summon help after being robbed. So come on, there were fewer violent women, but they get points for extraordinary range. Women also made remarkable strides in formerly male-dominated areas like property crimes, assault, petty theft, and homicide. Yet, they were still not judged to be as quote-unquote capable as men, perhaps because statistics continued to show that homicidal women kept leaning on domestic partners for a boost in sociopathy. By the 1800s, crime rates among women were decreasing again. But punishments for women became harsher due to a legal system that stereotyped women as passive, moral, caring, and angelic by nature. In other words, Victorian ideas of femininity meant that a woman who fell from her pedestal was an anomaly who was beyond rehabilitation. As a journalist for the Fort Wayne News put it in 1897, in the minds of legislators and public men generally, a woman fallen is down forever. Or, as inspectors of an Illinois prison wrote in their official report from 1845, from past experience, one female prisoner is a lot more trouble than 20 males. Which is why, in 1839, the Mount Pleasant Prison Annex, the first world-class destination prison designed especially for the women's, opened for business. Located on the majestic grounds of magnificent Sing Sing Prison, with a name like Mount Pleasant, they were ready to open their arms to female criminals of distinction. Their stated goal was turning their residents into, quote, true women by teaching them to sew and cook. Yet they went on to strike a blow for women's equality by showing the world they could also offer high levels of corporal punishment, frequent use of straitjackets and gagging, and continuous abuse at the hands of male guards. As pleasant as Mount Pleasant sounds, it was closed in 1865. In 1873, the Indiana Women's Prison became the first standalone female prison in the United States, built especially for women who had succumbed to, quote, unladylike crimes, like lewd and lascivious conduct, fornication, serial premarital pregnancies, adultery, and venereal disease, all the things that will get you on a reality show nowadays. This prison was separated into 2 parts, the reformatories, meant to rehabilitate moral character, in which the inmates were primarily white, and the custodial institutions, you saw this coming, right, whose inmates were mostly women of color, predetermined to have little rehabilitation potential, despite the fact that many were convicted of less serious crimes for which they also received longer sentences, dominated by physical labor and corporal punishment. As a bonus, conditions in this part of the prison were unsanitary, with inadequate sewage and bathing systems, lack of medical treatment, and the use of solitary confinement for women with mental health issues. As my grandmother used to say, what's not to like? I guess it could have been worse. These ladies could have wound up at the House of the Good Shepherd in Indianapolis, which opened around the same time and also took in convicted felons from county courts, specializing in fallen women, i.e. unwed mothers, seduced women, and prostitutes, committed by their families, priests, or courts for an indeterminate period of time, like, say, forever. These women were made to do the back-breaking physical labor of washing the clothes of others, sometimes for the rest of their lives, to cleanse themselves from their quote-unquote sins. And don't forget, laundry machines weren't common until the 1920s. The Good Shepherd was one of the 15 Catholic prisons for women in the United States modeled on the Irish Magdalene laundries. If that doesn't ring a bell, Google it and watch the documentary. I dare you. Plus, for added excitement, there were allegations of waterboarding and of women stripped naked and put into solitary confinement. And for bonus points, the staff doctor who cared for the women and girls at this off-the-grid reformatory from 1873 to 1883, a certain Dr. Theophilus Parvin, advocated female circumcision and removing of women's ovaries to cure nymphomania and masturbation. And right before this dump closed, a legislative investigation discovered that he had unrestrained access to 25 women and 100 girls on whom he performed operations for reasons that were unclear at the time, but became a lot clearer 3 years later when he published his extensively illustrated and detailed textbook on gynecology and obstetrics. On the bright side, let's hope that at least the laundry customers were very pleased with the whiteness of their sheets. Now for a stab at ending it something positive. In the middle of all this mess, there were also at large in the world women trying their hardest to make some kind of a difference by designing a document called the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments, which they presented at the first Women's Rights Convention in 1848. And even though newspapers insisted that the declaration was drafted at the expense of women neglecting their more appropriate duties, talk about fake news, and even though some supporters of women's rights believed the declaration's endorsement of women's right to vote would cause the movement to lose public support, and even though an article in the Oneida Whig described the document as the most shocking and unnatural event ever recorded in the history of womanity, it still dared to open with the following sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. And women being two words that were somehow mysteriously left out of the original version. Probably just an oversight. Cut to everyone I know rolling their eyes, jiggling their legs, and waiting.
At this point, I'm more surprised by the fact that bricks existed in 3000 BC than I am by the fact that they were used to crush the mouths of women who talked back.
You know, they had a lot of stuff in 3000 BC. I looked it up. They had soap. They had rope. They didn't have soap on a rope. But don't forget, they were also still at that time using crocodile dung as makeup.
Well, I mean, crocodile dung is organic. I bet with the right marketing, we'd be able to sell it in the beauty section of Whole Foods.
Maybe if you really adjusted the diet of the crocodiles, you could get it a nice shade.
We're trying
to match different people.
We're trying to disrupt the crocodile industry is what we're doing with this app that sells you shit to put on your face.
Yeah, well, we were used to putting shit on our faces anyway.
Honey, I know it. If debtors' prisons still existed, we would be having this conversation via payphone, I assure you, and it would be a collect call.
Yeah, as if I'm going to take your call.
Jesus, after all we've been through? After all the rapes we've read about?
You know I don't like to talk on the phone.
Well, I guess, do they let prisoners text?
I don't like to text either.
God damn it, Meryl. Well, there goes my data plan. Blemishes were a sign of being a witch? I'd be fucked. They didn't have proactive in the 1500s.
Just by the way, is proactive a thing you put on blemishes?
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
I have blemish-free skin, so I wouldn't really know anything about that.
Oh, I'm sorry, infant face. Some of us have adult acne, all right?
But I have every single other witch trait except for the blue eyes and the red hair.
Yeah, but how many signs of melancholy do you have?
Every single one.
All 18?
Mm-hmm.
You took the test. You took the BuzzFeed quiz on how many signs of melancholy you have?
Gee, imagine if they were doing that witch stuff now. BuzzFeed would be awash in how to tell if you are really a witch.
Thanks for circling back to marital rape, by the way. Sadly, both time and emotional constraints prevented me from discussing it in my piece, and I know Audible gave us that quota. So.
What was that quota again?
The quota is that we have to reference marital rape at least 18 times in this, otherwise we don't get paid.
Oh, then yeah, it's good that I do. I did reference it. I did that for us both.
I appreciate that. Thank you for your sacrifice.
Too many women feel there is nothing they can do to protect themselves if they're attacked. But there's no reason for a woman to feel helpless. There are many simple and practical ways for a woman to protect herself regardless of her size or strength.
Hold your purse firmly, close to your body. If a thief knows that you're on guard, he will look for an easier victim. If someone bothers you in a public place, if someone harasses you from a moving car, if anyone approaches you as you park, if you're in danger, if you receive an obscene phone call.
In the United States, a woman is beaten by her romantic partner every 15 minutes. Half of all violent crimes reported to the police each year are domestic. And according to the Centers for Disease Control, 93% of women murdered by people they know are killed by current or former flames. Since this is supposed to be a comedy book, I suppose I should insert a joke here for levity's sake. Okay, what do you tell a woman with two black eyes? Are you all right? Can I get you anything? A glass of water, maybe? When I was in my 20s, something happened to me that I, a lifelong feminist who prided myself on my refusal to take shit, never thought possible. I became a victim of domestic violence. It took me years to publicly, cathartically admit it, which resulted in me being threatened with a libel suit by my attacker because, well, life is hell. His sort of a lawsuit was so absurd it bordered on comical. Not only had he admitted to beating me, he had bragged about it. I was about to throw said threat in the garbage until a lawyer friend of mine sadly informed me my attacker had the right to send it. While I never mentioned him by name in the pieces I wrote about being a victim of domestic violence, context clues could lead people to him and the crime he, in the cease and desist letter his lawyer sent me, vehemently denied ever committing. Thus, the onus was on me to prove I was telling the truth, which required hours of compiling evidence and statements from people who were around to witness the aftermath of my degradation. A fun, flirty walk down memory lane that played like an episode of This Is Your Miserable Life. When a woman is the victim of a crime, the onus is always invariably on her to explain how and why it happened. Oh, your partner beat you? Well, why didn't you call the cops? I can't speak for other broads, but I can tell you why I didn't. It's because, to be frank, I didn't think they would do anything, in much the same way no one did anything on the numerous occasions in which I was beaten in public. Bringing the cops in felt as though it would only result in one thing, an increase in the likelihood of my attacker making good on his promise to kill me. My apathy for law enforcement isn't exactly uncommon. Many female crime victims are disinclined to go to the cops because they feel as though the risks in doing so outweigh the rewards. Not only will the act piss off their attackers, the authorities won't take their cases seriously anyway. Women have been reporting in smaller numbers of late. While the percentage of sexual assault cases brought to the attention of the police reached a high of 59% in 2003, it declined to 32% in 2010, possibly because women tired of being asked questions like, "Oh, you were raped? Well, what were you wearing? Were you drunk? Did you lead him on?" In 2016, a case wherein a teen girl alleged she was sexually assaulted by a teen boy while blackout drunk led the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals to rule that a person can't be found guilty of forcible sodomy if a victim is so intoxicated as to be completely unconscious at the time of the sexual act of oral copulation, which I'm sure made Bill Cosby think to himself, why didn't I buy a vacation home in Oklahoma? In North Carolina, a 1979 state Supreme Court decision gave women no legal recourse to revoke their consent once intercourse had begun. State v. Wade declared that if the actual penetration is accomplished with the woman's consent, the accused is not guilty of rape, even if the woman withdrew her consent in the middle of intercourse. And the ruling is still, in spite of it all, in effect today. In fact, charges against a North Carolina high school football player accused of raping a classmate were dismissed because of it in 2010. The district attorney who dropped the case conceded that it hurt and she told him to stop. The accused did not acquiesce to her desire and proceeded, while she continued to tell him to stop, but because the victim's initial statements to law enforcement and medical personnel do not indicate initial intercourse was without her consent, rather, the statements imply that she withdrew consent because of the pain she was suffering and that the defendant paid no heed but continued to hurt her. Therefore, applying State v. Way to the facts of the case, a rape has not been legally committed. The unscathed high school football player went on to play college football for the Appalachian State Mountaineers. And as we all know, if anyone has a wonderful appreciation for consent, it's college football players. In much the same way, nobody has more respect for women than Donald Trump. If you're thinking of getting porked without your consent, definitely don't do it in Oklahoma or North Carolina. And I'd strongly discourage you from doing it in Baltimore, too. A 2016 Justice Department investigation of the Baltimore Police Department found that the BPD seriously and systemically underinvestigates reports of sexual assault, especially those made by sex workers and trans people. According to the report, officers and detectives often question victims in a manner that puts the blame for the sexual assault on the victim's shoulders, with questions suggesting that victims should feel personally responsible for the potential consequences of a criminal report on a suspect, or for having engaged in behavior that invited the assault. In their interviews of women reporting sexual assault, BPD detectives ask questions such as, "Why are you messing that guy's life up?" BPD sex crime detectives treat female victims in a manner so flippant it borders on sociopathological. According to the report, a sex crimes detective told other officers and victim advocates at a party, presumably while French onion dip fell out of his gaping maw, "In homicide, there are real victims. All our cases are bullshit." In another case, a prosecutor wrote, "This victim seems like a conniving little whore," pardon my language, to an officer, who charmingly replied, "LMAO, I feel the same." I hope his ass literally fell off. Despite the movie villain-esque displays of cruel misogyny in the department, the BPD nevertheless employs some women. Slightly less than 16% of the Baltimore police force are female, a fact that led the male, swoon, director of recruitment for the department to declare he had no intentions on recruiting more. "That's higher than the national average," he said. "We're doing pretty good." While good isn't a descriptor I'd use when talking about the BPD, he is correct when he says the department has more female officers than most others. In 1996, women held about 14% of the country's law enforcement jobs. Today, they hold just 15%, a change of virtually nada in two decades. At the rate things are going, it'll be 700 years before women, who, by the way, comprise over half the population, hold half of all police positions. Assuming, of course, humankind lives that long. I pray the lady cockroaches who remain after we've been nuked into oblivion are allowed to, at least, patrol the nest. Which is unfortunate, as research has shown employing more female officers helps women who are victims of crime, especially rape, an act which, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, women make up 89% of the victims. Not only are women more likely to report cases like rape and domestic violence to female officers, those officers are more likely to take their reports seriously and follow up to prevent further acts of violence. Yet frankly, my dears, no one seems to give a damn. Deborah Friedel, the deputy superintendent of police in Lowell, Massachusetts, and vice president of the International Association of Women Police Officers, has spent over a decade trying to hype research that shows hiring female officers makes a difference, only to have her words fall on deaf ears. "I'm so discouraged at this stage of my career," she said. "There's no energy about doing anything to recruit women or show any effort to do your best to recruit women." Well, if the system won't work for us, fuck it. Sometimes we have to take things into our own hands. Each year, hundreds of abused women strike back against their attackers. At least 40% of women who kill do so in self-defense, and the New York State Department of Corrections found that 67% of women sent to prison in 2005 for killing someone close to them were abused by that person. Toward the end of the 20th century, feminist activists urged lawyers to begin to use self-defense pleas for women who were imprisoned for killing their attackers. Some won new trials, others were granted clemency. With the introduction of battered women syndrome to the criminal justice system in the mid-80s, expert testimony was finally allowed in trials to explain a battered woman's state of mind at the time she committed her crime. 70-80% of abused women who are charged with killing their partners, however, never go to trial, accepting plea bargains and given long prison sentences instead. And anyway, self-defense laws themselves are skewed against women. According to Cynthia Gillespie, lawyer and author of the book Justifiable Homicide, Battered Women's Self-Defense in the Law, which, not for nothing, led the then-governor of Ohio to grant clemency to 26 women serving prison sentences for killing their abusive partners in 1991, self-defense laws were originally designed for conflicts between men of equal strength and don't reflect the reality of domestic violence. They simply aren't applicable, Gillespie says, quote, for a woman trying to defend herself from a man who has threatened to kill her before. The best time to kill someone who's threatened to kill you without, you know, getting killed yourself is while they're unconscious. In most jurisdictions, however, battered women who kill their abusers in their sleep aren't allowed to claim self-defense because they weren't being actively abused at the time. Instead, they're charged with crimes like premeditated murder, which carry harsher sentences. But even if you don't go to jail for killing your attacker, domestic violence and women's incarceration are inextricably linked. 9 out of 10 women in jail have experienced physical or sexual violence in their lifetimes, and 75% have suffered physical violence by an intimate partner. Indeed, when you're a woman, a great predictor of if you'll become a criminal is if you've been a victim of crime yourself. A correlation exists between being a lifelong victim of abuse and becoming incarcerated. A survey of state prison inmates conducted by the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that a third of female inmates were abused as children, abuse that continued once they became adults. Only 10% of male inmates, on the other hand, had been abused as children, abuse that didn't continue to adulthood. Growing up in an abusive household makes many girls see little other option than to run away, a crime for which girls are disproportionately arrested. But running away isn't the only status offense. Status offenses, by the way, are crimes only applicable to minors, like truancy and underage drinking, girls are disproportionately arrested for. For decades, rigid expectations of femininity have caused girls to be more likely to be arrested for unladylike behavior like underage drinking and truancy than boys. According to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice, in 1956, half of the young women appearing before the juvenile court were referred for status offenses, but only one-fifth of young men were. The passage of the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act of 1974 helped bridge the divide a bit, but still didn't, suspend your disbelief, solve the problem. According to the Center for the Study of Youth Policy, more than 11% of young women being held in juvenile detention in 1987 were held for status offenses, as opposed to only 1% of boys. And speaking of locked-up females, the number of grown-ass women incarcerated has grown by more than 800% over the last three decades. Women are now incarcerated at nearly double the rate of men in this country, and nearly half of them are serving time for nonviolent drug or property offenses. The justice system, not expecting this development, had nowhere to hold these women who shouldn't have been arrested in the first place, which led them to being placed in converted motels, former hospitals, and abandoned training schools. In the past couple decades, however, states have built facilities designed specifically as women's prisons. Aw, isn't that nice of them? Women of color, as if their lives weren't hard enough as is, are disproportionately imprisoned. African-American women are 3 times more likely, and Latino women 69% more likely, to be incarcerated than white women. Yet prison isn't the multiracial barrel of laughs Orange is the New Black would have you believe. Generally speaking, women are treated more harshly in prison than men, often placed in solitary confinement for small infractions that would go ignored if committed by dudes. When women don't comply with traditional passive, demure standards of femininity, for example, many are punished with solitary confinement. Some prisons specifically isolate women who seem butch or not traditionally feminine. And many women who spent their pre-prison lives being abused end up being abused, wait for it, in prison. In 2012, an investigation of the Julia Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama revealed that male staff members had been sexually abusing inmates. The women who tried to report these crimes were often punished with solitary confinement, while punishments for the sexual offenders, when they rarely happened, were minuscule. "It's an ongoing thing, a daily thing," said a former Tutwiler inmate. "You see women raped and beaten, and nothing is ever done." Solitary confinement causes mental and physical distress to all inmates, but especially women. Women in solitary confinement are often sexually harassed by male guards who constantly watch over them while they shower and undress, robbing them of their privacy. Because so many female inmates have been victims of physical or sexual abuse, the never-ending presence of male guards forces them to relive traumas. Sexual assault at the hands of guards can also result in pregnancy, and pregnant women in solitary confinement, whether the pregnancy was a result of rape by a guard or not, are often denied proper medical care. And speaking of the wonder and the glory that is rape-based pregnancy, 7 states, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wyoming, New Mexico, Mississippi, Alabama, and Maryland, currently don't have any laws preventing rapists from claiming parental rights, which has resulted in some women having to suffer the intense, specific hell of co-parenting a child with their rapist. Of the 43 other states which have legislation that prevents this waking nightmare, 8 of them just adopted their laws in 2016. And the protections vary from state to state. In 20 states in Washington, D.C., for example, a rape conviction is required before a victim can request termination of parental rights. With the majority of sexual assaults not even making it to prosecution, the law, well, doesn't apply in most instances. Yes, the majority of sexual assaults don't result in prosecution, which is why many women don't go to the cops. And just like that, we've come full circle. God, this chapter was bleak, wasn't it? But hey, don't shoot the messenger. Not that you would, mind you. I'm not your girlfriend.
So far, you have seen many ways to protect yourself by avoiding trouble before it starts. But even if you are cautious and alert, you may find yourself in a situation where you have to fight for your life.
All right, so you opened your piece by saying that in the United States, a woman is beaten by her romantic partner every 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but I just have to say this. Shouldn't we call her? It's been at least 15 minutes since you read your piece.
Well, what if she doesn't like to answer the phone like you?
Oh, geez, I guess you're right.
I mean, we could call her, but she's kind of preoccupied.
Well, she's one of the few women who works on a schedule like that, a romantic schedule, a beating schedule.
You know, some guys don't. They just ignore the schedule anyway. Some guys love their women enough to beat them on off hours, is what I'm saying.
Oh, you're such a romantic.
I am.
In a related story, wasn't the phrase conniving little whore, wasn't that your rap name?
No, that was my band in high school.
Ah.
Which, the school actually made us shorten it to CLW in order to play the talent show. which we didn't even fucking win, by the way.
Did they ever put you on the bill? I bet you were always under and more.
No, I'm only under and more now. I peaked in high school.
And more is the place I always wound up too.
Yes.
I think it's where all the best acts are.
Indeed.
Chapter 8, Fashion.
Alas, Empress Poppy Sabaya, Nero's wife born in Pompeii. He kicked her to death, and then in the next breath he wept, "Who put my laundry away?"
Well, we're going to talk about fashion now, which has always been a real minefield for me because I was raised by a mother who was so critical of my clothing choices that absolutely every time I would wear anything, she would look at me and go, "You're joking, right?" Like that would be my idea of a joke, would be to put on a funny outfit first and try it out for her. And then she and I would have a good laugh and then I would go in the back and put on my real outfit.
Well, was your mother Joan Rivers? Or?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she was not Joan Rivers. In fact, I know she didn't ever find a way to monetize her cattiness.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to brag, but my mother never gave a shit about what I wore, which is why when I was in middle school, I was able to wear a novelty T-shirt with a clam on it that said, "Get shucked," which resulted in my being sent home.
You were definitely the funniest kid in your class, I'm guessing.
Real cut up.
And the only one with anything related to mollusks in the class.
Well, further compounding how inappropriate the whole thing was, it was her shirt, so.
Huh. Well, and when I went to high school, I pretty much every single day wore either black or dark green and then black boots just to let my fellow classmates know that I was living in a dystopian level of the world that they knew nothing about. And, you know, despite it, I think it didn't work very well because they still keep inviting me to the reunions.
Well, I mean, is it their fault that you make such great punch, or?
You know, you're right. You're really right about that. It isn't their fault. Fashion has always been a very triggering area for me. Dressing with too much of someone else's idea of flair makes me feel like a show-off who isn't sure what she's showing off. Fashion always seems to have things in mind for me and my body that we don't know how to accomplish, to say nothing of its attitude of superiority, that it is right and everything about me is wrong. And don't get me started on the incomprehensible world of accessories, like statement jewelry, something I avoid because I never get what's being stated. Then there's the nightmare of dressing rooms, which, if this world made any sense, would have lighting like a film that is shooting a sex scene and not a George Romero movie. And the erratic rise of something called vanity sizing, which has rendered most sizes of contemporary clothing absolutely meaningless, thus bringing us to a time when you always have to try on 5 different sizes, depending on which poverty-stricken 8-year-old child slave in Indonesia was hired as the foreman of the sweatshop that made your clothes. And by the way, word to the wise, look for Kaya. He's almost 9 and his work is very slimming. So I have given up for the most part. But on the rare occasion where I have to wear something that looks kind of good, that's when I know women's fashion will definitely let me down. Like that time I was nominated for an award some years ago and I had to attend a televised ceremony. So I went to a store that advertised a personal shopper, hoping the stamp of approval from a complete stranger might tilt the fashion odds in my favor. And sure enough, she helped me select a dress that she also accessorized with a purse, shoes, and statement jewelry in less time than it usually takes for me to finish hanging the blackout curtains up over my dressing room mirror. The centerpiece of my pricey new dress, which was purple with black details and had a V-neck, was a thick black velvety belt. And miracle of miracles, I thought the ensemble looked pretty good on me. So I decided I better not take it out of its protective plastic wrapping until just before the event, lest I spill coffee on it or Pepto-Bismol or get dog hair all over it, which are just 3 of the thousands of things that regularly befall a piece of my clothing.
So it came to pass that on the day of the big event, I felt unusually confident. My hair looked okay-ish. Everything seemed to be proceeding apace, except at the very last minute, before I got into the car that was sent to drive me to the event, I realized that a flaw in the belt fastening caused it to come loose and fall open whenever I sat down, or breathed out, or walked, or did anything. In fact, any movement at all caused the whole belt to open up completely. So my only option was to hold the belt closed with my hand that was not holding my accessorized purse. And all of this might have worked if all I had to do was sit in the audience. But because of a little-known law of physics I call Marco's Law, I won an award that night and had to go up on the stage, on television, holding my purse with one hand and my belt closed with the other, only to be handed an award which I couldn't take unless I grabbed it with my teeth, which I'm told is considered bad form. And that is fashion to me, an unexpected disaster waiting to happen at the worst possible moment. Although, the way my life usually works, if fashion had been working for me that night, I wouldn't have won anything. That's Marco's Law number two. And why it doesn't surprise me that the history of female fashion is a history of women coping with craziness. Back in the beginning, 5,000 years ago, clothing was saner because in the ancient world there were just a few basic garment types over and over in all civilizations. Any changes that occurred in style happened slowly over hundreds of years. Common clothing items were skirts of various lengths, shawls, lengths of woven fabric that could be draped or wrapped around the body, and tunics of varying lengths. The primary undergarment was a loincloth, wrapped like a baby's diaper and worn in most cultures by both sexes. In ancient Egypt, clothes were often white, which couldn't have been a good idea considering the fact that the makeup was made of crocodile dung. Egyptian women wore a long skirt with a very high waist, fastened with two suspenders, sometimes wide enough to cover their breasts. Sounds good, until we get to the part about the sari, a style of choice among upper-class women. The sari was a piece of cloth, approximately 4 feet wide by 14 feet long, that a woman would wrap by tying one corner to a cord around her waist on her left side, and then passing the material lengthwise around her back, gathering up some pleats along the way before tucking them into the cord at the front. Oh, geez, I'm sorry. This is making me feel panicky. I'm terrified I'm going to have a past life regression. You know, I know if I lived in ancient Egypt, I would have no idea how to wrap a sari correctly. I would be the sari laughingstock of Alexandria. I hope you don't mind if we move on before I get triggered. I knew there was a reason I had such a really bad feeling about ancient Egypt. On to ancient Greece, where most of a married woman's time was spent closed off, inside the home, being excluded from men's superior social gatherings. On the bright side, the fashion pressure was off, unless you were a courtesan or an entertainer on the bottom rungs of the social ladder, yet expected to look fetching. In the archaic period, the women wore something called a Doric peplos, a simple rectangle of woven cloth draped gracefully around the body and fastened with a long, sharp, dagger-like decorative pin that Herodotus says the women of Athens used to stab to death a messenger who brought them news about the defeat of the Athenians in a battle. So, a combination dress and lethal weapon. A good idea in any century. Uh-oh. I'm sorry, now I am having a past life regression. It's 500 BC, and I'm a courtesan, which I guess figures. I'm supposed to meet some misogynistic philosophers down at the Agora, but the rectangular length of fabric for my Doric peplos, which I just folded lengthwise and then placed under my arms, goddammit, now I can't get the damn thing pulled up. I don't know what the problem is. Doesn't help that there are no full-length mirrors yet. So how am I supposed to possibly repeat the same thing over the other shoulder when I can't even cover my boobs without stabbing myself with this goddamn dagger pin? Yes, I saw the woman next door wearing her Doric peplos with multiple belts. I would ask her how she managed that, but how can I ask her anything? She's not allowed to leave the house. How the hell can I get by as a courtesan if all the men are sneering at my Doric peplos? Somebody, help me. My Doric peplos is a tangled, filthy mess. What am I supposed to do?
Meryl, wad the peplos into a ball, cover your shame, and get the hell out of there before the men folks start throwing rocks.
Oh, I am so sorry. I didn't mean for that to happen. How embarrassing. If it's okay with everyone, I think I'm just going to jump ahead to the middle 1300s, when the historians date the start of Western fashion and clothing. By the way, The word fashion itself refers to the sociocultural phenomenon of clothing styles which become popular for a limited period of time. Now curved seams and tailoring started to make clothing fit the human form, which does not mean all our problems were over. Medieval clothes were sort of a status report about the person wearing them, which is why most women were not even allowed to wear their version of statement jewelry. A thing called the sumptuary laws was in place until the 16th